Very much, Kieran, and welcome to this decade. Kia ora tātou. First of all, you will notice maybe that we've got one panellist not here, and that is Tūroa. I was just advised by the association a few weeks ago that Tūroa wasn't well and wouldn't be here, but then I heard that he had been in Hawke's Bay at a farewell where he was the kaumātua for the Hawke's Bay District Health Board, and I rang Tūroa, and he sends everyone his warmest greetings. He is very, very sorry that he can't come here, but he wanted us to know that he is doing very well in terms of health. He thought it was too much to travel down and be here for this meeting, but he wanted his greetings to everyone to go from the meeting. And I know Sarah's going to talk quite a bit about Te Ranga Waewae and about the division of the and the growth of the association into a bicultural model. But just for those people who don't know, I'll just read what we've got here from Tūroa and his impact on ANZSW. And I think this era we're going to talk about is one of activism and change, and Tūroa represented that. His roles within ANZASW have been on the National Executive, Kaumātua Cultural Advisor, a friend and mentor, and, you know, when I spoke to him, that friendliness and that mentoring, just even over the phone, came through. And a teacher and advocate for Māori within Aotearoa and the association. The kaupapa for Māori competency, utilising the Niho Tanawhau tool, was developed by Tūroa with members of the Taiwanga Aotearoa Caucus. And his work was formally recognised when he was made a life member in 2003. And just really interesting, at 74 years of age, Tūroa graduated with a Master of Social Work and gained his postgraduate degree in bicultural supervision from the Wānanga. So a wonderful example of maintaining interest in education, interest in the association, and work for people. So just to acknowledge one of our members who aren't here. So just to start, we're going to start with Mary Nash, and most of you all know Mary. She is our activist, our historian on ANZASW. So Mary retired from Massey University in 2012. Most of you will have read her work on refugee and migrants, on social work and spirituality to interests. And like our third panellist, she emigrated here and worked in Palmerston North and was student unit supervisor, the same as Jackie, who is going to be our third panellist. So over to you, Mary. Thank you for introducing this decade.
Kia ora tātou. I have to say, I feel extremely nervous. The previous two panellists have been panels have been wonderful. I hope it'll be just as good. Yes, I came out here as quite a young woman, 1978, and I knew nothing about New Zealand. We'd even bought the wrong kind of car. We couldn't get a new windscreen for it. And so sitting here and looking back at it all, I realised some of the things that I witnessed and experienced happening, well, they were very strange to me. I'd never even heard of the Treaty of Waitangi when I came out. And my first hint of it was in the square in Palmerston North when Rahira Ohia, who was then a student, came up to me and she said, she was doing a survey. They used to do surveys as part of their research courses. She said, "Have you heard of the Treaty of Waitangi?" And I said, "No, what is it?" So it's been an onward journey ever since, and I've had some kind tutors and some fierce tutors. I remember Vapi Kupenga teaching me in some very severe and difficult ways, and Leland Rufu and Whetarangi Wash Tapiata being very helpful and equally firm, but very helpful in terms of clarifying things. So I've come a long way, and I realise I have ever more ways to go in that respect. But for me, this is a decade which I've called a watershed decade. And I'm very glad to say that I pick up where Lainey left off with the Warag report, which she mentioned. So I've mentioned a few things which I think signalled that it's a watershed year, a watershed decade. And I'm going to mention those quite briefly, and then I'm going to go on and talk about one or two things that took place during this decade which had particular significance for me and which I was aware of experiencing, and their importance for everybody. So the report of the Women Against Racism Action Group, we've heard a little bit about, and I'm not going to say anything more about it because I know our time is going to be pressured. And I've got a show and tell thing here, which is probably going to be very difficult to keep in order. But the next report is the Poverty Attitude Report, which I think really for social work has been such a wonderful contribution. John Rangiho chaired the Commission of Inquiry and went up and down the country collecting information and stories and witness accounts from Maori people and from others, putting on paper and taking oral submissions about what was going on in the country. And he was a very well qualified person. He was a graduate of Victoria University. He had mana. He was the ideal person to really get this message across, and his report was accepted. And it was a real challenge to social workers, Pākehā qualified social workers in positions of status and power. We all had to rethink what we were doing, why we were doing it, and how we could do it in a way that in future would be improved and culturally safe and useful instead of causing harm. So Poverty Attitude was broken upon the scene, and I can't emphasize that more strongly. And then there were some other reports, Unshackling the Hospitals, which came out with a lurid cover. I can't find any of my reports. I think I've given them to Massey, with chains. I was actually working in the hospital at the time. And it was the Gibbs report, and it really was advocating the funder-provider split. It wasn't implemented immediately, but it was eventually implemented. And it was one of those reports that crystallised that change in our society with funder-provider split and the contracting environment that we're now in sort of stems from there. And then I haven't brought the next thing, the April report. Yes, you all know why, because it's sort of five large volumes or six large volumes, I can't remember which. But Ian Shirley chaired that, and Ian was at the time professor of the social work programme at Massey University. And the April report, known as the Report of the Royal Commission on Social Policy, it met with considerable scorn from politicians and from the media. It was regarded as a great big thing to keep the door open. But actually, it was, if ever you read it, I think it's quite inspiring. And I think it caught the last moment almost. Perhaps not, perhaps I shouldn't be so pessimistic, but a moment of real idealism and hope in New Zealand society, hope for a fair and just society as being the measure we would take to measure our success. And, of course, it was overruled by what I've called an international tidal wave of economic rationalism and managerial innovation. Sounds quite good, doesn't it? I'm glad I wrote it down. Yeah. And then, I think it's a good thing to acknowledge Ian, because he was a very significant person and still is. And then there's the 1988, the PICO report, which helped transform education in the way that's delivered. So those reports are very significant, in my view anyhow. So I better go on to the next thing. Yeah, so ANZASW, now of course I've gone and lost my notes, so I'll find them there. Sorry, didn't mean to do that. So just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, ANZASW aims to develop our professional and practice standards. That's always been one of the key things that we wanted to do. And in order to do that, to foster social work education. That's always, and that's been signalled in the other panels already. And to provide members with a platform for discussion and information and research publications. And that's already been canvassed by previous panellists. But how did we do it in this decade? So some of the things that happened in this decade, developing our professional and practice standards. Always, the membership question has been a thorny one. It still is. I don't know about you, but I have had streams of emails coming across my computer about the membership question in the last year. Registration is still a big issue. We've got registration, but we haven't got mandatory registration. And so it's still up in the air a little bit. And accreditation has also been an issue, and it's one which we've signalled in earlier panels the association took charge of for a while. And racism and biculturalism are also significant. And I've really taken that little paragraph there from the New Zealand Social Work 1986 editorial challenge. Little plug for editorials. Do read the editorials in the journal. The ones I've written have been written with all my heart and soul, and I have a feeling they just get switched off. The people just turn onto the articles instead, but never mind. And the other thing, of course, is feminism in this era. Feminism and Sylvia's talked about that, and so has Lainey, and previous panellists, but it was very significant. And I came out here in 1978 from North Wales, where I'd not had anything to do with feminism at all. And I very soon got pregnant with my third child, and I very quickly met Ephra Garrett and the other strong feminists. I said to my husband, I don't think I'll tell them I'm pregnant. They might not approve. And then I noticed my husband, who was the one who brought me out here, he was lecturing at Massey, he was buying all these feminist books in my name. So we sort of explored feminism together. And when I was writing my thesis on feminist social work student placements, he actually typed it all out on the typewriter. It was before computers. And when I was proofreading it at the end, I said, Roy, you've put Marxism here and it should be feminism. So that was very, very important. All those moves. And they were very exciting for everybody. Very exciting. So anyhow, fostering social work education. This has been something that the association has been really has taken to heart and has put its put a lot of energy into. And the Education and Training Committee has been referred to already. I was lucky enough or privileged to chair it, but not in this decade. And I've just actually delivered my committee meeting minutes. Raw, unexpurgated, now I'm thinking what's in them, to the archives here in the National Office. So, but in those days, Education Training Committee worked very hard and liaised closely with the Social Work Training Council and NZSETAS. And the Social Work Training Council, I just want to mention it a little bit. It was reviewed in 1985 by our MERV and also by itself. So MERV's report was there. Quite a good, substantial report, and a very wise report, a report which aimed to be heard by everybody, because at that time the Social Work Training Council had become very unpopular for various reasons. It did do a lot of work. It was a good council. When it started, it was well-funded. Towards the end of its days, it wasn't, and it was unable to move with the times, in my opinion. But it did produce some things. It produced education and training for the social services. It produced a map of the training journey. It produced that every year, just about. It was very assiduous with that. It produced a supervision resource package, which I'm sure lots of you recognise, and that was very useful. Sorry, I can't see it properly, it's just too close. So that was the Social Work Training Council, but it was very monocultural, and it was very traditional. And it was disestablished, and in its place was NZSETAS, the New Zealand Council for Education and Training in the Social Services. It was quite different. And it was meant to be quite different. And it was established in 1986, a year after Puma Te Atatū came out, and it was bicultural. And it was a wonderful council, in my view, looking at it from the outside. And it travelled up and down the country, and Arfina Walker was there, and she said, we are not going to stay in hotels and spend a lot of money. We're going to take these, we're going to go on the marae, and we're going to meet the people, and we're going to rough it, if that's how you feel as Pākehā, but that's what we're going to do. And so they did. They had to just get on with a different kind of lifestyle, a different kind of committee to be on. And they produced the training, the accreditation standards, the ABC accreditation standards, which were quite significant for many years. They were accepted. The next thing, providing members with a platform for discussion and information and research publications. So research publication, I said I'd be talking a bit about the general and about the particular, what particularly interested me. In this decade, we had three titles, or two and a half. We had the New Zealand Social Work Journal, which we've already referred to. And then in 1988, we had Social Work Review. So that was the last issue of Social Work Journal, and this is the first issue of Social Work Review. I was on the editorial board of Social Work Review when John Bradley, who was on the editorial board as well, said, what about a tangata whenua issue? And we said, go for it. And in 1995, which I know is the next decade, but the seed was planted earlier, out came Te Komako. And we've been having Te Komako published ever since. So that was something of a triumph, wasn't it, Jackie? And you were on the editorial board too, and so were several other people here. So that was really great. So that, I just want to say that about the journal, because the journal is very important, I think. And it's very much part of our history. So now I want to talk a little bit about community work, because I think community work and social work should be close friends. I know they don't want to be seen as the same thing, but there we are. one of the publications that came out from the community work was Te Kupu. I don't know if anyone recognises that or remembers. I can see some heads nodding. And this was a very interesting journal that came out fairly regularly from the Aotearoa Community Workers Association. And I have quite a few copies of that myself. The community workers also wanted access to education and training, and that was a very big issue. It had been a big issue all through the days when they were trying to get accreditation for the youth work course in Wellington. They wanted to get accreditation for it, and they could not get it from the New Zealand Social Work Training Council. And that was one of the reasons why the Social Work Training Council became quite unpopular. And I've looked at the application they made for accreditation. I personally think it was very strong, but there we are. It wasn't quite traditional enough. So leading up to what happened next, in 1988, the Certificate in Social Community Work Practice was launched. Now, this was a very challenging certificate, and in that, I think for quite a long time, various tertiary institutions had been approached and asked to offer a certificate, and they didn't want to, because they knew, there were funding things and all sorts of other issues. But finally, Ian Shirley said, we will host the certificate in the Social and Community Work Practice. And it was to give access to community workers from the NGOs who needed some kind of accreditation. And I was appointed to launch that. to run it for 3 years, funded by the IHC and the CCS, from the Voluntary Welfare Agency Training Board. So I was, had been working in the hospital social work unit and came to Massey. I'd worked as a little, for a little while previously at Massey as the person helping with placements. But I was launched into this new venture, which was quite exciting and quite terrifying for me. And there was Randy Herman there, and Angie Bretta Herman, and a variety of other people. I think Mike O'Brien was there. And Ian Shirley, of course. And we had all these students, and then we had the staff. And it was quite a big lecture room, and the students were sitting in a sort of tiered place. And I looked up at them, and they looked down at me, and I thought, I'm going to run home. This is terrifying. And they looked, and Randy took the first course, and he the first lecture, and did an icebreaker. And we discovered that they were absolutely terrified of us. They were terrified of books. They didn't want to be at the university. What was going to happen to them on this frightening journey? And it was frightening for them, and it was challenging for us. And I remember someone coming down the corridor at Massey saying to me, oh, I've just seen one of your students. And I said, how did you know? Oh, they said, well, they had no teeth. And I thought, I, of course, hadn't noticed. They, a lot of the students were Māori students. They were from up north. They were people who had left school sometimes at the age of 13 or 14, and they were in their 40s or 50s sometimes. They were people who had had terrible experiences at school. I mean, they'd been told awful things by their teachers that they'd never get anywhere. And they were scared stiff. So anyhow, one of the things we aimed to do was to help them to learn, obviously, about social work, about community work, but there was a lot of personal development and conscientisation. And that was very painful for people who suddenly realised, particularly some of the women, who realised that there was life after abuse. But it was very hard to get there, to stand up tall, and to take charge of their lives. But when they realised that they could do that, it made a big difference to them. I've got here one or two. Am I going over time? Yes? Oh, God, no. I'll just say one or two things that the students said to me when I did a little tiny checkup on evaluation. A comment that one of the students wrote to me at the end of her third year. She said, like many others, I'm sure I carried the label of being dumb, lazy, or difficult. Labels that I had carried with me through life until I confronted them head on with applying to do extramural studies at Massey University after never having touched another academic ability since those dreaded school years. With bated breath, I waited. Could I achieve a certificate at tertiary level education when school certificate was such a trauma for me and apparently my teachers alike? In the final year of my study at Massey, I think I can clearly say I can. And she did. And then one other thing before I close down. After meeting our students and giving them a lecture, Charles Waldegrave, Anglican Social Services Family Centre Lower Hutt, wrote to me saying he was very impressed that a course like yours, well, it was ours, not mine, is being offered. I did not realise that community workers had an opportunity to get the opportunities you were providing without being alienated by an academic system. And I think that signals how hard the staff really tried to work with and for the students. And I think the course was a really very good and valuable course. So I just want to tell you that little wee bit about a little adventure we had at Massey with community workers. And
thanks. Thanks very much. I'll hand straight over to Jackie.
Do you want to turn that off, Karen? It's sort of distracting.
Kia ora tātou. First of all, I'd just like to acknowledge my friend, my colleague and my neighbour, Nerve, whom I was looking forward to flying down with and spending a weekend with. I'll just have to wait till he comes back home so I can go up for a cup of tea and have a chat. and I meant Turoa, sorry.
Thought you did.
I'm very nervous, so just forgive me. I meant Turoa. And Merv, of course, who was my supervisor for 15 years, as well as the person for whom I did my degree with and has influenced my career in all sorts of directions. So I just acknowledge those. I am very nervous and I have written it, so you must forgive me for reading. I just hope my blood pressure keeps reasonably low.
Yeah, you do.
Keep an eye.
Yeah, just keep an eye on me, will you? I think this was an important decade for social work. It was for me anyway, and I expect, and I've already picked up that other people have found it was quite an exciting time. I must admit my memories are a little bit fuzzy, and more or less what I have to say fits more or less in within the time frame that we've been given, but things aren't always quite working into set patterns, and there's a bit of a overlap, but then that's life, isn't it? It doesn't work in little sections. It was 1984 in particular was a significant time for me because I was 4 years out of my social work degree. You can see by my white hair that probably doesn't fit with me having been 20 years old at the time. I was much older and probably one of the first adult students to study social work at Massey University. All my other students at the time were about 18 and I was about 40, so I'm meeting them now, and they're now older than what I was then. So it's really their grandparents, some of them now. So 1984, I was 4 years out of the degree and working in the Department of Social Welfare, which I'd never heard of actually before I did my degree. But it was also the year I went to the IFSW, the International Federation of Social Workers Conference in Montreal, as a delegate for the NZASW, as it was called then, which was an exciting adventure. And one of the things that we did as a association here, we lobbied at Montreal for the Federation to become anti-nuclear. And there was lots of little wigglings and wogglings and talkings and networking beforehand. I can see some nodding heads there. And so I'm very proud of the position that we took at that time. And there were a lot of us involved in the anti-nuclear movement. And I can remember joining a circle of people trying to hold hands around Palmerston North to declare it nuclear free. We didn't quite make it around the whole city, but we did try. And I remember writing a letter to the paper declaring 86 Churchill Street, where I live, as a nuclear free zone. And of course, 1984 was the year that David Longy declared this country nuclear free. And one of our members who's sitting in the audience just here, Lainey, sailed into the Pacific, I think. I'm not sure about the year, Lainey, but around about that time?
On the second wave of free treaties.
In the decade?
Sorry, next decade.
Okay, never mind. She sailed into the Pacific for us, so I just acknowledge that. So 1980s was a time of protest marches and submissions and many attempts to change things for the betterment of other people. It was the time of the anti-racism movement and of community work, both of which I was heavily involved with. And as you can tell by my accent, I'm not New Zealand born, and so I take an interest in what goes on in England, and of course we've got the miners' strikes going on over there, and Thatcherism and the anti-racism movement as well. And of course feminism, as we've already been told, was alive and well. But then we had that not very nice word called Rogernomics, and then there were those economic policies which changed, I think, our lives forever. So before then, we were able to practice what we believed, and the funding for community work and the workshops became harder and harder to obtain, but you have a ball while you get the opportunity. So I found it an exciting time, and I hope other people did too. But what I wanted to really talk about was whatever happened to Marx, because In my social work career, I've been privileged to meet personally many social workers, as I've supervised practitioners and students for about 34 years, since 1980. And I've also been involved in the competency program for ANZSW since its inception in 1990, either as a national assessor or as a panel member. So again, I've either been privileged to read the portfolios through the recertification or the initial assessment process, or to meet them face to face. And in those years, I've challenged many social workers with, now, what is your theoretical perspective? And if that question scares the living daylights out of them, I've usually rephrased it, where does the fire in your belly come from? And I found that usually works. People know what you're talking about. So I thought it was about time, in the twilight of my career, that I owned up to my own theoretical perspective, which has underpinned my work. And I can't keep saying I'm eclectic. It's very useful, and I am eclectic, but, you know, I think you've actually got to come out and be honest about things. So I'm doing it now, I hope. So what drove me to work the way I did and to do what I did and drives me still? You remember that, you know, when we've done our training, that we've all been urged to understand ourselves and to, as rookie practitioners, as to, you know, where we come from and where we got our values and beliefs. And my background has had a huge impact on my beliefs. Now, many of you will be familiar with Downton Abbey, some of you. Some of you are old enough to have remembered Upstairs and Downstairs. Well, I'm a product of that environment, and definitely not upstairs. I know that the series is fictional, but what it portrays is essentially true. My parents were downstairs, and my mum worked in service from the age of 12. So I was brought up basically, well, I was told as a child that I had no rights to rise above my station, and that I was born to a certain station in life. So I was actually born knowing all about class. I didn't have to learn it at university. So it was really interesting when I went to university to find they'd actually written books by a fella called Marx. Not Groucho, apparently, somebody called Karl. And while I was there, I discovered Paulo Freire and his liberation theology, and who, of course, was also influenced by Marx. And I was enamoured by Geoffrey Galper, my battered copy, which another social worker passed on to me at some stage, and my social work practice, which is a radical perspective on social work. They were my Bibles in my early days of social work, as I became heavily involved in the anti-racism movement and community work. And I seemed to be able to do it all while I was working for the Department of Social Welfare and the hospital board. I even had community development written into my job description at some point. Freire, as you, if I pronounced it properly, wrote the Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which I think probably had a huge influence on the thinking of the anti-racism movement. And hence we did workshops on structural analysis where groups were able to analyse, you know, why they were in an oppressed situation. And according to Wikipedia, which I do look up now and again, this book was banned in South Africa. And that probably accounts for the fact that while I was attending the IFSW conference in Montreal, any attempts that I had to talk with black social workers were discouraged by the white social workers. They wouldn't let us talk to them. But I did manage to have a meeting with one of the black social workers, but we had to have it in a cafe outside of the venue, sitting at the back watching the entrance in case we were spied upon, because it was extremely dangerous for the black social workers to be seen to be talking to us. Anyway, I really wanted to know, you know, what sort of efforts, because many of us, and I know 1981 is not our decade, but many of us social workers were involved in the Springbok tour, which I don't think we've mentioned so far. I don't know about you, but every Wednesday the other social workers in my office were out marching around Palmerston North. So I'm sure many of you were also involved in that too. So we wanted to know, you know, what sort of efforts we'd had. I did have a copy of another book. It was a little green book, and it was all the photographs of the Springbok tour, which I took in 1984. And I did actually manage to get to some of the social workers there to show them these pictures of us protesting, because they'd never seen them. I never saw my book again, so I hope nobody got into trouble, because it was very risky for them. So we've already... To move on from that, you know, as we progressed from the Springbok tour of 1981, I think that was a watershed that we as Pākehā began to look at our own racism. I remember being in anti-racist groups when I raised the issue of racism in New Zealand. I would get, oh, well, we don't have any racism here. We're all one people. And I think I believe it was the watershed of us actually starting to look at ourselves. So we've talked about the WARAG report, which again was another significant part. And as this book in particular I found is very useful for as a tools of practice, you know, how to have a radical perspective when you're working in a government department. So I because as I took on this job and I thought, oh my God, why did I say yes? Sorry, but I thought I'd better do a bit of digging around and see whether Marx was still alive and well. And I found that he's you know, behind the empowerment theories, behind the oppression theories. And I thought, I expect there's plenty of others. And I've come to the conclusion that the names change, but the ideas don't. The ideas are still there. And I couldn't help having a dig at strength-based practice. It's common sense for a community worker. Is there any other way to work? So I think the challenge for our future for the next 50 years is to keep communicating with each other. And for me, the importance of that is networking. I know it's another damn meeting, but it's who you know which is important, not what you know. You can't know everything, because when you need to know, you need to know who to contact, and you need to team up with others battling the same issues as you. And in conclusion, I'd like to finish with a poem. I've called it a poem, whatever, called Decide to Network, and it's by Dr. Robert Mueller, Secretary General for Economic and Social Services for the United Nations, which I obtained in the 1980s and has been an inspiration for me, you know, all of this time. Excuse me. Use every letter you write, every conversation you have, every meeting you attend, to express your fundamental beliefs and dreams. Affirm to others the vision of the world you want. Network through action. Network through love. Network through the spirit. You are the center of a network. You are the center of the world. You are a free, immensely powerful source of life and goodness. Affirm it, spread it, radiate it. Think day and night about it, and you will see a miracle happen, the greatness of your own life. In a world of big powers, media and monopolies, but of 4.5 billion individuals, networking is the new democracy, a new form of happiness. In order to work towards social change, we need our fellow social workers. And by golly, we need the ANZSW. So, network and enjoy. Kia ora.
Thank you so much, Jackie. And now I'll pass on to Sarah. Thank you, Sarah.
Karen, could we put the logo up again? If you can. Thank you. Yeah. Ngā mihi mahana ki te whānau ka hui mai nei ki tēnei rā. Ko Sarah Fraser toku ingoa, nō Waihaupai aho, inaenei e noho ana aho me toku whānau ki Māpua i tētou ihu o te waka a Maui. Hi, I'm Sarah Fraser, the elusive Sarah Fraser. Jackie had messengers out looking for me through the conference. It's a real pleasure to be here, and thank you so much for the opportunity for being part of this panel. It's been very exciting, lots of fun going back through all our recollections. I just want to say that I've been particularly keen to look at the lead into and the events that happened at Tūranga Waewae Marae, where we first began the bicultural structure of the association. But I feel a huge weight of responsibility in that and being one voice that's telling the story. There are many stories and lots of perspectives to be told about it, so please take what I say as mine. I've tried to incorporate as many as I can. I had tried to contact Kathy Holland and Rahira Ohia, who were the two first office holders for the Māori caucus at the time, to talk to them too, but unfortunately we made contact too late to be able to incorporate it. So I promise that's another story to come that we'll write together. And I also wanted to include Liz Beddoe as part of this, because you can't have the 80s without Liz, and she's behind a lot of the things that happened at Tūranga Waewae as well. So if we have any questions, please feel free to direct them at Liz as well. Just to set the context for my involvement, 1983 was my final year at Massey. At that time we could live on the student allowances, we didn't have any debt. We had four placements if other people were students then, so we had two over the summer breaks, and the government actually paid us allowances to do those placements. Merv resigned as head of school while I was there, and Ian Shirley took over. I began my first social work role at Waikato Hospital in 1984, and Gay Tozer was president of the association then. There was a total membership of 450 at that time, which continued to decline through the 80s. It wasn't strong. And there was significant concern at the time I first became involved about the relevance of the association. Community workers were looking at separating up and setting up their own groups. Youth workers were saying that the association wasn't relevant to them. It was a bit of a crisis time, really, for us. And competency and registration issues, as others have said, were already on the table as big issues for us. As others have said, at the time we had the Social Work Training Council, and Eve Hesse and Jeanette Papish represented the association on it. The council were about to produce in the early 80s a document on minimum competencies for social work in New Zealand, and there was widespread concern among social workers that there hadn't been a lot of consultation about that, and concern about what was going to come out in that report. The association had undertaken a national questionnaire on registration and had a proposal ready for conference in Christchurch in 1984 to put those proposals forward. But the Working Party on Racism had also prepared a report, which I think was called Race Against Time. Is that right, Liz? Yeah. Which was also to be presented then, the different perspective. I found an editorial that Alison Davies and Sue Kemp had written in March 1984 in the journal. People do read the editorials, Mary. I just thought I've got a quote out of it because it captured a lot of those debates of the time really well. As social workers, we must look beyond our daily practice in confronting issues of racism. Take, for example, the current NZASW debate on registration and accreditation. Emphasis in the debate has been given to the establishment of professional standards of competence, the wish for protection of clients, and the issue of possible elitism within the association. However, as social workers become more active in addressing racism, it's clear that the policies of our own association must also come under scrutiny. What are the implications of registration and accreditation for Māori and Pacific Island social workers? What will be the criteria for acceptance? Who's going to decide? What about access to training and agency recruitment and selection policies and practices? So that conference in Christchurch in 1984 was the first one that I attended as a young graduate. I remember the incredibly heated debates that took place there, resulting in those proposals for registration being defeated, and two new remits were passed. They've been recorded for history as the famous accountability remits, And I'm guessing that Liz actually turned coined that phrase because it was in one of the editorials as well, that in the News and Views. So those remits have probably been lost somewhat in time, but they really set the pathway for where we've gone since then. The first was that this general meeting of NZASW recognises the need for an establishment of a system of accountability of social workers and social work services to consumers, the public, employers and the profession, and that the National Exec set up a suitably qualified representative working party to put together a plan to bring to the next AGM. Do other people remember being the Christchurch conference? Yep. So the National Executive itself became that working party, and the plan became much of the focus of the work for the next 2 years. The other thing that happened then was that in an attempt to bring a bit of life back to the association with its falling numbers, the executive structure changed again. Instead of moving from region to region, set up with two representatives from each branch coming to those National Exec meetings. And that's where I became involved on the national stage as one of the reps from the Waikato branch with Madeline Taylor, who's also a key part of this time. So my recollection of that time is, of those 2 years, was driving up and down the North Island in a carload of social workers to get to the we had no money, to get to the executive meetings. We used to sleep on the floors of each other's flats. We used to drive up to Auckland and sit around Liz's floor, stuffing journals into envelopes, and all done on the smell of an oily rag because we had no funds to make it happen. And as others have mentioned at that time, a key factor that I also want to mention is that the setting up in 1984 of a Māori Advisory Committee at the Department of Social Welfare's Auckland Regional Office. It, as people might remember, released a report in 1985 concluding the department was racist in the institutional sense. And at the same time, those nine women from the Department of Social Welfare released their report on institutional racism, which we've heard talked about several times. I'm really pleased that that's happened because I think that there hasn't been a lot of official recognition for that group who really put their careers on the line to it was such a brave and radical thing to do. And Lainey said, many were social workers and members of the association. I just wanted to name them here. So they were Denise Berridge Lainey, Tanya Cumberland, Alison Davies, Heather McDowell, Judith Morgan, Lizette Riley, Anne Ruck and Paula Wallace, names which will be familiar to many people. An editorial of News and Views in Social Work noted that 1985 could well be remembered as the year in which social work in Aotearoa New Zealand made some small, tentative steps towards acknowledging the hard facts of institutional racism. It also noted that students had held pickets at Massey. I don't know if you remember that one.
I was out of the country.
Oh, Mary's out of the country, didn't see those. And groups of Māori, Pacific Island and Pākehā students had formed to challenge monocultural practices in Auckland and Wellington as well. The other big issues that were happening at the time were making the submissions on the Children and Young Persons Act, and Mike O'Brien in the Public Questions Committee led the charge with that, of course. Jocelyn Seralak, people might remember, was also heavily involved in the international social work and in that the peace issues and the nuclear issues portfolio. We'd written letters to the rugby union about a rugby tour to South Africa. Public Questions Committee presented submissions on the Homosexual Law Reform Bill. There was concern about suitable housing for psychiatric patients. We wrote a letter to the French Social Work Association expressing concern about the nuclear testing. We sent letters of support to the Prime Minister about setting up a peace commission. Those were all things that were happening in the background as well. We also continued the work of looking at whether the association should become part of a federation with other social service agencies, organisations, as a means of survival, really. And during that time, the Working Party on Accountability struggled to come to grips with the whole area of accountability and competency and registration and service to clients. pressure was really mounting on us to do something, because not only had the Social Work Training Council set up their own working group to look at those competencies, but DSW had also set up a working party and were looking at setting standards for their own workers. It looked like the qualities required of social workers might be determined by the employers rather than by the profession ourselves. So it was about that time that Ken Daniels, who may well remember himself, published his paper on the issue of competency in social work. His conclusion was that it presented a challenge to us, raised concerns about our task, about the education and training that we needed, and about the professionalism of social workers. And to continue the debate, there was a fantastic editorial in the News and Views in August and September of 1985 that put forward an argument against registration. I just love the way that was written, so I want to read it here. Registration, an imported model, is about status and elitism, largely based on the possession of rigid formal qualifications. It's a mere smokescreen of the real debate about what social work is and where we should stand in relation to our clients and the state. Registration borrows the mantle of power from other professions while pretending that we'll be strong and noble enough to withstand the seduction of the system. Remove the mantle and we stand not naked, but wearing the grey suit and tie of the oppressor. That was great. So these debates about racism, about competency, accountability and registration and the very survival of the association set a fiery context for the 1986 conference, which was called Social Work in Te Ao Hurihuri, Social Work in the Changing World, which we held at Turanga Waiwai in the Waikato. John Kavanagh chaired the conference committee and I was one of the members of that. People who were there might remember that Wally Hirsch, who was the race relations conciliator at the time, was the keynote speaker. And the principal themes, of course, were about those three issues: racism, accountability, survival. The Accountability Working Party presented their report, and I can't find a copy of it. I'm hoping someone might have it somewhere. That was presented to the members, and there were facilitators from the National Council of Churches there to lead the discussions that followed afterwards. I have to say that the report did not go down well, which is putting it mildly. Māori social workers present left to consider it separately, and for those who were there, you might remember that that moment that can't be forgotten, when the Māori social workers returned to the main conference, said nothing but turned their backs on the rest of the body of the conference and then left without saying a word, totally rejecting the proposals as they considered it didn't recognise or meet the needs of Māori at all, and as a consequence the association itself. So the conference was, as you might imagine, was left in total disarray. It was an incredibly emotional moment, and it could have seen the end of the association. I can't exactly remember what happened next, and I hope someone will come and tell me at lunchtime. I suspect Merv had a hand in it, as usual. But the two groups carried on meeting in separate rooms to try and find a way forward. And the group, which later came to be known as the Manuhiri Social Workers, put together a new statement of accountability, which was based on one particular principle, which I'd also like to read. I promise I'm going fast. The bicultural identity of Aotearoa is based on the Treaty of Waitangi. NZASW recognises Māori people as tangata whenua of Aotearoa and affirms their right to self-determination. We also acknowledge that power over resources and decision-making is held by Pākehā. Bicultural practice requires that tangata whenua and Māori here contribute equally to policy and decision-making at all levels and have an equal access to resources. In addition, we recognise existing Māori models and initiatives as alternatives to conventional monocultural practices. We acknowledge the work of the Working Party on accountability and our responsibility for it. We consider the report must be rewritten to give full adherence to the application of the principle above in relation to the Code of Ethics, the Code of Practice and Competency. And that's where all those things that we have today came from. We commit NZASW to use every available resource to promote biculturalism and actively support those engaged in anti-racism activity. The Māori Caucus took that statement and came back with a simple line which said, "Statement of principles, right on." and with respect to rewriting the accountability report, that should be done by equal numbers of Māori and Pākehā social workers. So from there, agreement was reached, the association would take on a new bicultural structure, which is the forerunner of today's, with two co-presidents, one Māori and one Manuhiri, a secretary and treasurer, one of whom would be Māori, and two delegates from each region, one Māori and one Manuhiri. And the intent was for that structure to keep NZASW continuing on until the Māori social workers could hold a national hui so that they could go back and consult with social workers from the iwi areas to see what they should do in the long term. So Kathy Holland from the Māori caucus took on the role of association secretary, and I became the Manuhiri president, and I continued that long line of tradition of going to conference as a helper and coming out as the national president. And there's another long story in that. I was only 24, so I was pretty naive. But we were full of hope and excitement about what could come. And Rahira, of course, was later confirmed as the president for the Māori caucus. Kathy wrote another letter to the association in the newsletter that I'd just like to read a brief bit from here. She wrote it so well. She said, "Kia ora, congratulations to the Manuhiri caucus. The birth of NZASW is a bicultural entity. I don't wish to dwell on the content that brought conference to this stance. What I want to recall are the strong feelings of the conference, the apprehension, the hopes, the warmth, the determination, the frustrations, the tears, the powerful presence within Te Rangawaewae, the laughter, the togetherness, the strength, and that eloquent silence. The new bicultural structure of the association has come at last." So the first Māori caucus members of the National Exec included Rahira, Tautahi Pihama, Silla Henry, Piki Rehana, Ahiria Tehira, Edi Motu and Kathy, whilst the Manuhiri caucus included Liz Beddo, Jim Murphy, myself and others. So the next chapter in the association is a whole other story, and we had hoped that Turoa would be here to tell that and to give the other perspective, of course, of what happened. So I can only say, because it's not my story to tell, that in brief summary, the Māori caucus undertook a series of regional hui to consult with Māori social workers around the country, while the Manuhiri caucus continued with the general business of the association. And I think I can say on behalf of us, of those of us who are involved in the Manuhiri caucus, that in terms of that, we saw that our role was to, as far as we could, provide the resources for the Māori caucus to do that work and to make the space in support of the structure in whatever way that we could, making the space, really, so that could all happen. So the National Hui for the Māori Social Workers was held in April 1987, but was unable at that point to resolve the issue about whether to stay or not. And somewhere around then, the name changed to the Tangata Whenua Caucus as well. They were deciding whether to stay within the association or become a separate group. Yeah, I'm on the last paragraph. Oh, God. More consultation followed, whilst both the caucuses began the work on developing the standards of practice for the association. And in the first social work review of 88, I wrote as a Manuhiri president. 1987 was a difficult year for NZASW as we confronted our own racism and attempted to support the fledgling Tangata Whenua caucus. At our AGM in November, Rahira Ohia announced that the caucus had come of age and that the Tangata Whenua social workers' choice was to stand alone and gather their strength and resources before looking at partnership with Manuhiri in NZASW. So amongst both groups there was much sadness at the parting of our ways, but at the same time excitement for the aims and goals of Tangata Whenua. A strong and genuine commitment was made to keep in close contact with each other and work together where appropriate. And the issue around accountability wasn't lost either. So the ongoing work of the association in consultation with the Tangata Whenua caucus came the proposal for the establishment of an NZASW qualification in social work practice, which has become our certificate of competency, the bicultural code of practice, and the practice standards against which the competency of social workers is assessed today. And the dream of a bicultural association wasn't lost either. Look at us here today. Thank you. Thank you.